This is They Create Worlds, episode 209, Accolade, part 1.
If anybody wants to find me, I'll be in the last place you would look. In a place where people used to be, a land that's called reality, you'll find me there.
Welcome to They Create Worlds. I'm Jeffrey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex.
Hello.
This time we know the truth. It'll be two episodes, not one episode, and all about the accolades of Accolade.
That's right. We are finally closing one of the major plot holes in the TCWEU by covering the company Accolade. Longtime listeners may recall that during our annual live stream back in 2022, at one point when Accolade came up in the conversation, I started, as I do, referencing prior episodes and talking about and telling people to remember that when we covered Accolade, and then, of course, longtime listeners and my co-host had to be like, Alex, there's no Accolade episode. And it's like, you do 200 of these. Who can remember? I mean, I don't listen to the episodes. I just talk. And then Jeff does some kind of magic and it turns into a podcast. So yes, at that time, there was no Accolade episode, and now we are going to close that plot hole in the universe by taking a two-part look at the company's history.
You know, I could just go back and just re-render that episode and say, oh yes, episode 210 and 9.
Nah, history has happened. As a historian, I do not condone going back and editing the historical record. It happened, and we all live with the consequences.
But you said for something that is in the past, history sure does change a lot. I'd just be changing and fixing it with the future.
Well, there's changing because we learn new things and unearth new sources, and there's changing where we just lie about what happened. And I'm more about the former and a little less about the latter.
Okay. Well, probably a good thing. It would take me a while to edit that anyway.
But the important thing is, we will have a couple of Accolade episodes now, starting with this one, and then one more. This one basically covering the 1980s, and the second one basically covering the 1990s.
80s and 90s. So we're back to our bread and butter time frame.
I suppose so.
For those who may not be aware, what games is Accolade known for?
We'll get there in the course of the episode. No need to spoil everything for the listeners all at once up front, but...
It's called a teaser. You gotta tease them. You gotta draw them in.
There'll definitely be a few recognizable hits if you were a fan of the video games at that time, I think it's fair to say, or computer games more accurately, since they were not in the console market.
Well, at the very least, I can tease to people this way. Looking at a quick list, I know that there's a certain character... that a certain Discord channel that we hang out in is popular? Question mark?
If only ironically. Sadly, though, that is a part two situation, not a part one situation. We won't be going there today.
So how do we start off this nightmare?
Well, we start at the beginning, as we always do. So Accolade, as a computer game company, was a direct spinoff from the company Activision, the first third-party console game developer, publisher. Accolade was founded in 1984, and it was established by two of the co-founders of Activision, Alan Miller and Bob Whitehead. Of course, this is the period of the crash that we're talking about here, and Activision, being a company that was almost entirely dependent on this time on the Atari 2600 as its primary revenue stream, was in a bit of a pickle, as we have talked about in our episodes on Activision and its mediagenic years. We talk about all of the craziness that is going on in this time period, the 16 consecutive quarters of losses, the attempts to pivot into new markets, and only having a limited degree of success in that at first. All of that drama is covered in other episodes, but that drama leads directly to the founding of Accolade by Messrs. Miller and Whitehead. The real driving force behind this really was Alan Miller. Miller, of the four programmers that left Atari and essentially co-founded Activision together, Larry Kaplan was technically not a co-founder because he got cold feet, didn't join right away, and joined them 2 months later. But for our purposes today, we'll refer to them all as kind of the co-founders, even though technically Larry Kaplan wasn't. Of those four programmers that left to form Activision, Alan Miller was always the most business-minded of them. He was also a brilliant game designer as well. His basketball game for the Atari 2600 was absolutely incredible, considering the limitations of the hardware that he had to work on. He created fantastic tennis and ice hockey sports games for Activision, as well as fantastic takes on Battlezone and Star Raiders under the names Star Master and Robot Tank. Now, of course, once again, because we have done a lot of coverage of Activision over the years, we did do an episode where we went through basically almost the entire Activision 2600 catalog. So for more information on some of those games, you can turn there. So Alan Miller was a phenomenal game designer, but he was also very interested in business. He did not have a lot of experience in that area, but it was an area that he wanted to have more experience in. He was really, in a lot of ways, the ringleader of the Activision folks. I don't know that he was necessarily the first one that came up with the idea that they should talk to management about what's going on when the Activision 4 were unhappy with their lack of royalties / lack of recognition that they received for their products. But he was definitely the one that went to the next step and put together a proposed royalty program for use with the VCS programmers at Atari based on practices in the book publishing and music business. So he was the one that was really looking out for the business angle when it came to the Activision people from the very beginning. And he was also, in some ways, the most hesitant to go with the original Activision plan. I mean, technically, Larry Kaplan was a little more hesitant since he didn't. But he came back 2 months later. Alan Miller, according to Jim Levy, who was the other founder of Activision, the business guy. Again, you can look at our Activision episodes for more of that founding history. Jim Levy told me when I interviewed him that Alan Miller very nearly backed out at one stage while they were all feeling each other out, seeing if they wanted to work together, because he was afraid that Levy did not have the entrepreneurial chops, having largely worked with established companies throughout his career, and was kind of hesitant to join Activision at the beginning, though he did eventually sign up. I imagine, and I don't know this for certain, unfortunately, the one protagonist in all of this that I have not been able to interview is Alan Miller. I've interviewed Bob Whitehead. I've interviewed, of course, Jim Levy at Activision. I've interviewed several Accolade CEOs. Alan Miller has basically about a decade and a half ago, or maybe about a decade ago, just stopped giving interviews. I don't know why. He used to give interviews all the time, and we do have some material on the record from him about Activision and Accolade from prior interviews, but he hasn't given one in a decade. I've tried to contact him without success. Others have as well, so I don't know what happened there. So we don't have full insight into what Alan Miller was thinking. We do have some, because he has given interviews. But I have to imagine that some of that hesitancy and some of that doubt that he had about Levy and about the foundation of the company was still lingering at the time of 1983 when he was getting restless and wanting to leave the company. Of course, he brought Bob Whitehead along with him, who was very good friends with him, but Miller was really the driving force in wanting to go out and create a new company. And the reason that Miller and Whitehead have both given publicly for why they wanted to found their own company is that they felt that Activision was trapped by the console industry. There's probably a little bit of truth to that, quite frankly. Of course, you know, their primary revenue stream at this time was the 2600. Most of their game development was geared towards 2600 game development. The programmers are all people that cut their teeth on the 2600 for the most part, and so are particular experts on that system. It was a blow when they could no longer rely on that 2600 platform for revenue. They were pivoting to home computers even at this date. When Miller and Whitehead say Activision was not effectively pivoting into the home computer market, that's not entirely true, because they were, and they had always planned to. They had already been undergoing a transition to putting more product on things like the Commodore 64, but they were shocked by the speed of the collapse of that 2600 market, as was everybody. So they had not fully transitioned to new platforms at that time, but they were in the process of doing so. Another thing that they've kind of said in interviews that I think may be a little closer to the point is not so much that Activision was not transitioning to computer products, but that Activision was still caught in a 2600 mindset, by which I mean the types of games, the type of gameplay that you would expect to find on a home console like the 2600 that's targeted primarily at 6 to 12-year-olds, quick action games and that kind of stuff, was still, even as the company was beginning its pivot into home computers, was still prevalent. Miller and Whitehead both very much saw a move towards the Commodore 64, which was clearly, by end of 1983, becoming the dominant home computer platform. That shift to the Commodore 64 was not only going to allow more sophisticated games, but was also going to allow computer games to reach a more sophisticated audience. We've talked about this before in other episodes. While young people certainly played games on the Commodore 64, in fact, my co-host here is very, very much among them, because of the expense of home computers, even after Jack Tramiel's price war had driven a lot of those prices into the ground, the expense of a home computer meant that there were going to be a lot more teenagers, college students, and even young professionals that were playing around on these computers, and you weren't just having an audience of children. A home computer was not seen as just a toy. So the users of said computers were not just seen as 6 to 12-year-olds. So they did feel that there was a real opportunity to expand the notion of what a video game could be or what a computer game could be. I think, aside from whether Activision was transitioning fast enough from the 2600 market to the home computer market, I do think it's probably fair to say that at this early stage, now this would change very much later, and in fact, it would change too much, as we talk about in our Mediagenic episodes, they get too ambitious and too out there. But at this very early stage, they are still very much in a kind of VCS mindset. I mean, their big hit of 1984 was Ghostbusters on the Commodore 64. And it was a massive hit on the Commodore 64, but they also did release it on the 2600. And it was, in a way, an extension of the kinds of games that they were already doing. So I think it may be more about lack of innovation on computer platforms rather than strictly lack of moving to computer platforms. Now, of course, the other thing that James Levy is quick to point out is that the company, Activision, successfully went public at the beginning of 1983. I mean, it may not be quite literally, but it was essentially like the day after those stock options from that initial public offering vested in the founding stockholders was the day that Miller and Whitehead said, by the way, we're leaving. They had a bit of money now. I mean, they weren't like Microsoft millionaire kind of wealthy or anything of the kind. I mean, these are people that are still going to be working for a living. But they had some wealth behind them now. They had some capital. So there was just an opportunity here to strike out on their own, which I think probably appealed to Alan Miller especially, because the Activision people got what they wanted out of Activision in terms of just compensation and royalties for their products and recognition by having their names and pictures splashed on the boxes and manuals, etc. But they weren't the management of the company in any real way, shape, or form. None of them were on the board of directors. Even though they were the co-founders, you know, with Jim Levy, none of them were on the board of directors. They got founder stock, so again, they were getting compensated. But they weren't corporate presidents, they weren't corporate vice presidents, they weren't board members. Once the company has gone public, of course, they're not even the quote-unquote owners anymore. I mean, obviously, they still own a portion of the company because they have founder stock. But it's a public company now. You know, they don't even have that authority of being owners of the company anymore. And I have to imagine that that chafed Alan Miller, especially, since he always had a bit of an entrepreneurial bent. There's a lot of things that are going into this whole let's found our own company with blackjack and hookers thing. But that's basically what they were doing, is being like, okay, well, the video game market has crashed and Activision isn't doing so well. We'll found our own video game company with blackjack and hookers.
Yeah, I forget the whole thing.
Except they're not going to forget the whole thing. They're going to do it. So that's kind of the background to why Accolade comes into being in 1984, is basically Alan Miller and Bob Whitehead are a little nonplussed with the way that Activision is weathering the crash of the console market. They're concerned that the company is beginning to lose its way, that it's too wedded in the past to be able to pivot effectively onto new platforms, and they've just come into a bit of money with their stock options vesting, which means that they have the financial independence to go out and found their own company. So that's exactly what they do. In a move that's very unusual in this time frame, they really do it with their own money. They do not take venture funding. For one thing, it's almost impossible to get venture funding for a video game slash computer game company at this juncture, because the venture companies had started jumping in on that bandwagon in 1982, just in time to run headlong into the crash. Venture money wasn't dominant across the industry by any means, but companies like Sierra, Broderbund, and Electronic Arts had taken some venture money in the 1982-1983 time period. Those firms were in the short term, longer term they'd be okay, but in the short term were really kind of feeling bad about that. There would have been no way to get good terms anyway. They might have still been able to get a venture company to invest, but they would have had to, I'm sure, given up way more control than you normally would have to for way less of an investment. But they had money because they had their stock that they could sell. Each of them put in about $250,000, quarter of a million. So with a $500,000 initial seed, they established Accolade in 1984. Even though Alan Miller was a very entrepreneurial type, he knew that he was not, at this juncture, ready to run a company. I wouldn't be surprised if, even at this point, he had ambitions to do so one day, and spoiler alert, he will eventually become the CEO of Accolade. Even though, as I said, he has this entrepreneurial bent to him, he does not have that background. He is an engineer and a programmer by training and trade. Whitehead has even less interest in being involved in running a company than Miller does. They knew that they were going to need to bring in somebody to run the company for them. They initially turned to some of their cohorts at Activision, some of the lower-level VPs that would maybe be looking to step up in the world and go from being a VP to a prez someplace, were unsuccessful in recruiting anyone that way. And so they went just a little bit outside to an individual by the name of Tom Frazina, who had been running Androbot for Nolan Bushnell. Frazina, other than being kind of adjacent to the video game industry with Androbot, had never really been involved in the industry before, but he had some experience. He was a green CEO when he was at Androbot, but running Androbot gave him some experience running a company, and he liked games. I mean, he was into the games themselves. He and his sons had discovered Pong and all the arcade games that followed video games in the 1970s and were fans of this stuff. He was kind of adjacent. He kind of knew people who knew people, you know, kind of all in the same, like, extended circle. You know, he had this business experience. So they brought in Tom Frazina to run the company. He's not, unlike Levy at Activision, he's not a co-founder of the company. The co-founders are very much Miller and Whitehead. Frazina's brought in to run the company. And of course, there's a board of directors, and Frazina's on the board, and there's a couple of outside directors, but Miller and Whitehead are also on the board because, as I said, part of moving to being with this company, Accolade, is having more direct control over what the company is doing, having more of an ownership and a management say than they had at Activision, where they were starting to feel like the company was not in step with where they thought the future was going. So we've got a company. Great. Now, why is it called Accolade? Well, there's one very, very simple reason for that. And again, this is straight from the co-founders, so this isn't some kind of speculation or urban legend. This is the truth. It is called Accolade because all they did was open a dictionary and look for some good, positive, powerful words that came before Activision alphabetically.
Just to stick it to their former place.
It wasn't to stick it to them. I mean, they're not leaving under that kind of animosity. I mean, they're obviously, you know, Jim Levy's not happy that they've decided to take their toys and go home. It's not like it's completely amicable, but it's not ugly like that. It's very professional. But no, the reason for it is the same reason that one of the reasons that Activision became Activision, because it was before Atari alphabetically. There is an advantage to being listed first or last, essentially, in any kind of listing of things. In this case, we'd most commonly be talking about either in the old phone book in the Silicon Valley area, or I think even more importantly than in the phone book, in trade show catalogs and publications. There's something about being at the top or the bottom, because we as humans tend to see the things at the top, eyes glaze over, skim, get to the bottom, notice the last couple of things, and we're done. There's actually a good marketing reason to be as far up the chain as possible. They wanted to basically be at the top of the alphabet, but they wanted to do it with a word and a name that made sense. They weren't just going to call the company AAAAAAA to get to the top of the phone book or the catalog, because that doesn't do anyone any good. You also need a name that people are going to remember.
But it works so well for AAA.
Right. But that's the entire reason that they chose the name Accolade, is they were just looking for good words that appeared before Activision in the phone book. Incidentally, one of the other words that they looked at and considered as a name was Acclaim. Of course, a couple of other ex-Activision people, Gregory Fishback and Jimmy Skoroposky, would later adopt the name Acclaim for the exact same reason that the Accolade people chose Accolade, because they were all playing this one-upsmanship game in the old phone book. So, small world there. We've got a company, we've got a name, we've got management in place. What is our raison d'etre? What are we going to offer here to the public that a company like, say, Activision is not? We may recall that when Activision was founded, and of course, we're talking about two of the founding members of Activision here, so what Activision was doing at its founding is very germane to what Accolade may be doing at its founding. When Activision was founded, one of their key tenets at that time is that they felt they needed to have the most graphically superior VCS games that they could provide. The logic for that being that good gameplay is great and important. They weren't looking to have, you know, all shine and no substance. But in order to convince the public to buy something from another company when this has never been done before, when you've never had the concept of a third-party publisher, when you're greeting a skeptical public that's going to ask, why the heck should I buy from you, especially since generally their cartridges were slightly more expensive, why am I going to buy from you instead of from Atari? They had to have something that they could hit the public with right away. They could be like, bam, here's why. Deep gameplay, while you want that, and of course the Activision games absolutely had that, that isn't going to be enough, because that's something that you have to take a product home and you have to play around with it and get familiar with it before you really feel that impact. And they need something now. They need something that punches you in the face immediately. They can't hang on the ropes until you tire out, to use some very strained boxing metaphors. So they chose to focus on graphics. When Accolade is getting started, they basically make the same kind of decision. Once again, they saw the Commodore 64, and believe me, their target platform, even though they would port to other systems, their target platform was the Commodore 64, which at this point had slain all comers in the home computer price wars that we covered, of course, in some past episodes as well. The Commodore 64 is a great sprite-moving machine, has a fantastic audio chip, the SID chip. So they saw this platform as a platform that was going to be able to push forward the state of games generally. And what they really wanted to do is provide greatly enhanced multimedia presentation, graphics and sound in their games, and tie in with established tropes and presentation styles that were present in other entertainment media like movies and television. to create products that they felt would really stand above what everyone else was doing in the market at this time, which was still largely either very simple action games in the Atari 2600 mold, or in-depth strategy games like early RPGs and adventure games and strategy war games that had some deep mechanics to them, but on the whole were not graphically impressive. You know, they came up on console, so they weren't looking to do text adventures. They weren't looking to do RPGs. They were still looking to do action games, but they wanted action games with a little bit more depth, maybe a little bit of light strategy on top, and with a new graphical and aural sheen that really stood them apart from the competition. That is basically where we're at with the founding of the company in 1984. They also make a decision very early on that they're going to use a combination of in-house and external talent to create product. They kind of focus on the internal first with using external companies as porting houses, and then they kind of expand out to also be taking original concepts from external developers. Again, there are a couple of reasons for this. They kind of take a similar approach to porting, essentially, as Electronic Arts does, which is, of course, getting up and running in this exact same period. Now, they don't provide all the resources, the development stations and whatnot that Electronic Arts does, but basically, Miller and Whitehead see themselves, quite rightly, as very creative people and very talented game designers, and they were. I mean, their track record at Atari and Activision speaks for itself. The idea was that they should always be creating new, exciting product. You don't want your most innovative, talented people stuck spending all their time doing ports. So it was decided very early on that they would entirely outsource porting. They would pay other developers to port their games to other platforms. And they did plan to robustly support other platforms. They don't want to waste their main talent on that. Once the company got established a little more, and, you know, they'd gotten their first few releases out and money was starting to come in, there was an understanding amongst Frazina and Miller and Whitehead that their goal was to be a big player across the computer game field. It made no sense to make their internal developers work outside of their areas of comfort or their areas of familiarity. By which I mean there are tons of genres out there. If Miller and Whitehead are primarily action and sports games guys, which they are, then why have them making flight simulators? Again, it makes no sense. Yeah, you can hire people to fill in other niches, but they could only afford to have so much internal development, and that internal development was never going to entirely line up with what's popular out in the world. So, you know, they start using outside developers as porting houses, and then they start leaning on the expertise of outside developers to fill in areas in the catalog where their internal development team is not so strong. Now we've moved through the founding, we've moved through the general philosophy. Now, I suppose, seeing as this is a video game history podcast, we should probably talk about a few games, huh, Jeffrey?
Might help.
Right. So the company launched with essentially three products. I don't know that they all came out like on the exact same day, but they came out within a short time of each other, and they were kind of the three initial projects that were done internally. Those were Alan Miller's game, Law of the West, fellow Activision alum Mike Lorenzen's game, Sci-Five Trading Company, riff on sci-fi. Of course, the biggest hit by far of the initial bunch, Bob Whitehead's Hardball. Turning to each of these three products in turn, all three of these were designed to emulate something popular in movies and television, and try to bring a slightly more cinematic experience to these action and sports staples. Law of the West, Al Miller's game, was entirely all about Westerns. It took great inspiration from things like High Noon and Gunsmoke and all of these classic Westerns on film and television. It wasn't a very successful game. I don't know that it's a game that came together particularly well at the end of the day, but it was a very interesting concept for a game because he wanted to give it some of that narrative structure, give it some of that tension that you get out of a gunfight scenario like in the classic High Noon, which, as I said, was one of the primary inspirations, but also needed to have an action game underlying it because these are action game guys. They're not looking to do an adventure game or a Western RPG. What he comes up with is a game that mixes conversations via dialogue tree with townsfolk and ne'er-do-wells and whatnot with third-person action sequences where you're shooting at bad guys. I don't know, because I haven't done the research well enough to know this. This may not be the very first game to have a dialogue tree set up like this. In fact, it probably isn't, because whenever one falls into the trap of trying to assign a first, they always get outflanked by something that came before. This was one of the very first games that gave you a variety of responses in a list on the screen that you could scroll through and choose the response you wanted. Very similar to what classic adventure games would do a few years later, like everything coming out of Lucasfilm Games / LucasArts in the Monkey Island and Day of the Tentacle kind of vein. It's a very innovative game in that sense, having the dialogue options set up in this way. I think of the initial three games, it was most likely the least successful. It didn't make too much of an impact. It ended up being actually Alan Miller's last game, not because of any ill will towards that product itself, but because Alan Miller really was interested in flexing his entrepreneurial and business muscles rather than his game development muscles at this stage in his life. And so he basically voluntarily retired from game design and started immersing himself more in management positions in product development and business development, though, of course, Frazina was still in charge of the company. So that's Law of the West. Then Sci-Five Trading Company, it's sometimes kind of inaccurately called a space trading game on the internet, but it's not really. It's really a riff on Star Trek, doing space combat in the style of the Star Trek television series, but you do control a cargo ship, and you do have to get some commodities from point A to point B without losing all of those commodities to raiders that are attacking your ship. But there's not actually an economy where you're buying low here to sell high here, like, say, Elite. It doesn't have that kind of thing going on. It's basically a space combat game set up very much like being on the bridge of the Enterprise, even though you're on just a generic space trading ship and, you know, it's not the Federation because there's no license. Your ship has the various familiar stations, engineering and sensors and weapons and all of this, damage control and navigation. You have to plot a course to your destination and you have to be on the lookout for enemy raiders and you have to fight them if you get attacked. Your goal is to get as much of your cargo to the destination planet as you can. Your score depends on how successful you are in getting that cargo there. We have our Western-themed game. We have our Star Trek-themed science fiction game. And then finally, we have our TV sports game in Hardball. Now, obviously, Hardball is not anywhere near the first baseball game. It's not even the first baseball game Bob Whitehead has created, because he created the original baseball game on the Atari VCS. He's always been drawn to doing sports game. It's not even quite the first to experiment with bringing a more television-centric approach to baseball, because Don Daglow and Eddie Dombrower at Mattel were experimenting with that a little bit at Mattel right before the whole video game industry went belly up. What it did do, and what it did do very well, is it brought the feeling of participating in a TV broadcast of a baseball game, having that kind of slick presentation. So it was one of the first, if not the very first, game to present the action of the batter-pitcher matchup from the view behind the pitcher looking in at the batter, which is the classic television camera angle for baseball games. Most baseball games at the time, I mean, the ones with more primitive graphics were overhead view. If they were in a more sophisticated graphical setup, they were invariably always from the point of view of the batter, focused on the batter at home plate looking out towards the pitcher. And this has flipped it, so it's from the pitcher's point of view looking in towards the batter, which made it feel more like baseball you saw on TV, which tied right into their goals of providing a more cinematic experiences in computer games. It also had a little more strategy than a lot of the baseball games at the time did, because it actually had not only the ability to choose where you wanted to locate your pitch, but it also forced the batter to choose where they would locate their swing. So there's a grid of like 9 squares representing inside, down the middle, outside, and then high, mid, low, a grid of 9 squares. As the pitcher, you would choose your pitch and your pitch location on this grid. And then as the batter, you would choose where you wanted to swing as well. And so there was this a little bit more strategic depth to the batter or pitcher matchup than you usually found in other games. And it had some impressive graphics and all of this as well. And so it was really unlike any of the other baseball games that were on the market at the time. As a result, this is the one that became a smash hit of these early games. And I mean, it was huge. Those that listened to our 100,000 series of episodes where we went through all the games that had sold 100,000 units or more in the United States in the 1980s, according to the Software Publishers Association, may recall that Hardball was on the sold 250,000 or more list, which is massive, massive success on a computer platform of the time. And of course, that was over a course of a number of years. It wasn't just right when it came out. And it represents ports to multiple platforms, not just the original C64 version. But that game was truly monumentally popular.
The game, if you look at a list of it and what ports are during the early part of Accolade, Hardball is the one that's ported to the most different systems. It's got a ZX Spectrum port.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do something that looks this good on a ZX Spectrum? I'm not sure if I want to look up that video or not.
Probably not.
I mean, they even ported it to a console in the early 90s.
Yeah, and the series lasted for basically the entire length of the company. There were multiple of them released over the years. This was the big one, and it was really that presentation and a little bit of strategy element that really made it work. All three of these initial games had really good graphics and sound because they went out and actually got experts. They had an artist by the name of Mimi Doggett, who was doing all of the graphics in their initial game. They got a real composer by the name of Ed Bogus to do the music and sound for these games. So they looked great. They sounded great. They mixed some storytelling and cinematic presentation and strategy together. Even though only one of the three was truly a huge hit, all three of these games combined did a very effective job of demonstrating what Accolade's philosophy was going to be going forward with games. We've got ourselves established now, but the best is really still yet to come, especially as they start taking in more outside projects. Because while they continue to do internal games, their internal games aren't really their biggest strengths. It's really their external product that they get from other developers that is some of the best product they put out. I mean, of course, Alan Miller is stopping after Law of the West, for instance. He's making no more games. Bob Whitehead gets caught up over the next couple of years trying to do for football what he did for baseball with the game Fourth and Inches. While that game is very worthy of a footnote for being the first computer football game, action game to feature 11-on-11 football, because it came out before John Madden football did. And it did sell over 100,000 units, so it wasn't a failure by any stretch either, because it's on the list of the 100,000 as a 100,000-plus seller. It's kind of slow and clunky. We've talked about this in some of our EA and Madden episodes, because there was a reason that the early games didn't do 11-on-11 football, because the systems of the time couldn't really take moving all of those objects around at the same time at any kind of speed. And Electronic Arts was eventually able to solve some of those problems, but Whitehead really wasn't. So Fourth and Inches is a pretty clunky game. Though, like I said, it's still 100,000 plus seller, which means it still qualifies as a hit. So the internal team is either turning away from games or is getting bogged down in some of this. So it's actually the external product that really gathers the most attention, I think, and does some of their best work. Certainly all the rest of their 100,000 sellers on that list outside of Fourth and Inches and Hardball came entirely from outside developers. In terms of that product, the first kind of significant outside development product they had, which I don't think was very successful, but is nonetheless interesting, was the game Sundog Frozen Legacy from the company FTL Games. Sundog was an actual space trading game, whereas some people inaccurately call Sci-Fi Trading Company a space trading game. Sundog actually was. We're not going to go into the history of the development of that game because FTL is a company that very much deserves its own history someday, and it's not worth shoehorning that information into this one. Just suffice it to say, it was one of the very early games that came out at Accolade as well, released in 1984. They actually picked that one up at the West Coast Computer Fair, because FTL Games was at the West Coast Computer Fair, and Accolade was there as well. The Accolade folks were just blown away by this game, which was a pretty sophisticated space trading, you know, economic game for the time period. So they signed that one up and released it. The only game from FTL they released, FTL's far more important game that came later, Dungeon Master, was not released by Accolade. Nonetheless, that's kind of the beginning of this. The other big games that they got initially actually came all from the Great White North of Canada. Again, this is because they were looking for ports for their products on the Commodore 64. So they were looking for porting houses. And once they would establish relationships, then they would give these companies the opportunities to do their own games as well. The first prominent company that they ended up working with is a company called Sydney Development Corporation, which was one of the very early Canadian software companies. They were not initially in games when they started. But once the game industry was starting to get kind of big, they bought a small company called Artec, which had been founded by some graduates of a college called Carleton College that were working together, and they were doing some entertainment product. And so Sydney bought them and made Artec their game development arm. Artec was contracted to do some porting for Accolade. Then they really got into the field of military simulations, which were starting to become big on the back of some of the early MicroProse product, etc. So they created a kind of military simulator with a heavy action bent called Ace of Aces, which was published by Accolade. That game did really well. Again, it's on that list of 100,000 sellers that we always talk about. It was a game that was very much, came out in 1986, and it was very much in the same vein as kind of the early MicroProse output, like Hellcat Ace and Mig Alley and whatnot, in having just enough of the simulation elements to make it feel like you're having to pay attention to your flying a little bit, but really focusing on the action side of the equation primarily.
As Alex lists off all these games, I'm doing quick lookups of each one, and it's really interesting to see how there's different takes on it, but they all have a lot of sophistication, especially for the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
Ace of Aces, I'm looking at a C64 version of it. Yeah, it's doing the whole slow frame, but it's at least 5, maybe 6 frames per second, which is pretty good for back then.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it has the whole setup of, hey, here's your loadout. You got that going on. You have the color scheme looking pretty good. Saw a DOS version of it with everyone's favorite pink everything.
Good old CGA graphics for color. Do you like pink? Do you like cyan? Then you will love 4-Color CGA graphics brought to you by IBM.
Sundog Frozen Legacy, just skipping around in this one, you have a thing that shows like a system, a very detailed map. You have all these menus and stats and stuff. So it's a very pretty and seemingly sophisticated trading game.
Yeah, it really is. It doesn't have the same expansiveness and sense of possibility that Elite would have just a year later. It's a little more narrowly focused, but it's running a small-scale galactic economy and really do to meet the objectives of the game because you're trying to basically bail out this one colony. And in order to do that, you basically have to hop around to other systems, exploring the galaxy and hop around to other systems and, you know, following supply and demand, buying low in this system so you can sell high in this system so that you can get the colony this resource that they desperately need at a reasonable price kind of thing. I mean, it's really playing with some of those economic factors quite well.
Law of the West, how they're able to just make it look fantastic and realistic. That kind of thing that happened a lot with C64 games where they did this full color graphics setup, and because of just little tricks of the artist and because of different zones of what could have different color palettes, you had a very convincing backside view of a cowboy about to grab its gun. You have a beautiful background of a city, and then you have parallax layers of various people and bad guys walking across the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you have this dialogue tree underneath it. I'm going to throw all this fun stuff into the show notes, but go definitely check it out.
Of course.
Fully appreciate just how crazy this stuff is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what comes from, you know, pairing expert programmer like Alan Miller with an actual graphics artist like Mimi Doggett. Make sure that you just have all of this stuff humming in tune together. Like I said, some of the game concepts themselves worked better than others, but nobody can deny from these very early games that they were masters of combining gameplay and presentation, even if sometimes the gameplay, in all honesty, left a little bit to be desired.
Oh, yeah.
Hardball is one of the very, very few computer games that I had in the 1980s. And I had the PC version because, you know, we never had a Commodore 64. We went from totally legitimate, I promise, not counterfeited in any way, Apple II that we bought in South Korea, straight into a PC and never did any of the home computer platforms. So my experience was on the PC version. It really stood head and shoulders above a lot of the other games of the period. And even when we had some of the NES games, because we're talking a little later on now, even when we had some of the NES games like Bases Loaded and Baseball Stars and whatnot to fool around with, we would still, from time to time, you know, my friends and I still go on the computer and play some hardball because we did appreciate kind of that extra layer of strategy that the game provided. Couldn't field on any of these games worth a darn, but, you know, that's another issue. The batter-pitcher matchup was truly quite fun, though we did figure out pretty quickly that because of the way the fielding could be and because of the weakness of the computer component, we did soon find out that the best thing to do was just to always bunt because it was pretty easy to always make contact with the ball. And then because of the way the fielding was, we were almost always safe. So that was probably not really in the spirit of what they were hoping you would do. I mean, it really did have great graphics, great animations. I did appreciate that over the shoulder of the pitcher camera view, even as a kid. I watched a lot of baseball as a kid. Even though I also played a lot of Bases Loaded and whatnot, we still played some hardball on the PC as well.
They have even a full roster that you select there, which looks like the standard scoreboard back in the time. You have the scoreboard up there and a little pennant that says Accolade Incorporated.
I just want to interrupt real fast. The rosters, there's two teams, and it's all made up of Activision employees and their families, is the names of the players.
Then the over-the-shoulder view is really, really cool. It looks very realistic, especially for early 80s, mid-80s.
Yeah, mid-80s.
This is really, really good graphics. Even as I'm watching this, you have sort of this cheeky thing where you have like even a guy who's sort of in a dugout off to the left. He even is animated and like looks away and does little hand signals and stuff. Just like little details, little touches.
Right, which is all what Accolade was about in the early days. It's like, we're not going to sacrifice depth of gameplay. You know, same with Activision on the VCS. We're not going to sacrifice depth of gameplay. But let's make sure that we have a cinematic presentation that is really solid, and let's make that the thing that really makes our game stand apart. That kind of takes us through most of the games up to 1986, but there is one other very important game from 1986 that we have to talk about, which was again an outside production, and that was the golf game Mean 18. Mean 18 was created by a gentleman by the name of Rex Bradford. Rex Bradford got his start in the video game industry as one of the initial programmers hired by Parker Brothers when they were establishing their VCS development division. He was the creator of Empire Strikes Back on the VCS, which was one of the two initial launch titles for Parker Brothers and also one of Parker Brothers' biggest hits on the system. He also followed that up with another Star Wars game, Jedi Arena, which is kind of interesting for what it is. Came out in 1983, and nobody was really going to care about that. But Empire Strikes Back was a bona fide hit and a bona fide classic. Once Parker Brothers started cutting back, he actually briefly joined Activision, which is how the Accolade people knew him and he knew them. This was during the period, and we talk about this in our Activision episode, when as other companies were shutting down, Activision, which had just gone public and therefore had a lot of money, was locking up all of this talent in what it called its regional development centers, which was essentially the precursor of the modern studio system. So when Parker Brothers laid off a bunch of its people, they set up a design center, I should say, not development, a design center in the Boston area to pick up some of those laid off Parker Brothers folks. So Bradford very briefly worked for Activision, but of course, Activision, as they started really feeling the effects of the crash, they had to pull way the heck back and close most of those design centers. So he was very quickly out of work again. At that point, he joined with another guy to found his own game development company called Microsmiths. It was here that he first turned his attention to a 3D golf game. When we say 3D golf game in this time period, we are not talking about polygonal graphics or anything insane like that. 3D means something very different in the mid-1980s than it means today. The idea is, you know, you had basically two kinds of golf games. You had more primitive top-down golf games, like the early golf games on the Atari system and some of the other consoles, where you're basically just trying to choose your... It's basically like playing Pong, so to speak, except with little golf players. I mean, you're not batting a ball back and forth, but you're choosing your angle and you're choosing, you know, where to nudge the ball, and it's just XY coordinates. You don't have the Z. Of course, real golf, you're not just putting the ball down the green. You're also driving the ball down the range, so you need that Z-axis as well to really properly simulate the game of golf.
The first one's more like mini golf.
Exactly. And a lot of the early golf games either build themselves as mini golf games or as putting games, as opposed to full golf games, to kind of forestall some of those expectations. So when we're talking 3D golf games, we're talking about, in this context, talking about games that are played from a behind-the-golfer perspective of camera view, and you're also figuring the height of the golf swing in addition to the length that the ball goes. You're calculating height as well. There had been a small number of 3D golf games that had come out to this time, but they tended to be overly finicky. Because golf is a very complicated game when you're talking about the physics of it, because you have your choice of club, you have the power of your swing, you have the direction of your swing. There's so much that goes into determining how a golf ball gets from your tee to the general vicinity of the hole you're trying to get that golf ball into. A lot of the early games were very simulation-focused, trying to calculate all this stuff and portray all of this stuff accurately. This was leading to the action of the golf game to just being really clunky and kind of uninteresting to play from an action perspective. Bradford, though, was a big fan of golf, was really keen to do a golf game and really keen to solve this problem. And so he came up with the brilliant solution that became literally the solution for every game going forward. That is the three-click swing.
Dart, power.
Yes, I was going to say, I don't know how many golf games you've played, but since you're clearly familiar, why don't you elaborate just slightly on what you said on the classic three-click swing of a computer golf game.
Most of my experience is actually with the Nintendo golf game, which I played a lot for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And the principles are the same, because everyone imitated Bradford on this.
Well, I was going to say, after skipping around Mean 18 here in the video, it's like, this looks a lot like Nintendo's golf here, especially when you're on the putting field and you have the little arrows kind of indicating how the grade of the green is and where it's flat, where it goes down. Anyway, to get back to the three swing thing, typically how it goes is you start the thing, so you go back and you try to figure out how much power you want to put into it. Do you want to do like a full swing, half swing, three-quarter swing? You want to just tap it a little bit. Then when you come back, you want to hit it as close to where you started as possible. Otherwise, you're going to be off center. Hit it too soon, then it might veer to the right. If you hit it too late, it might veer to the left. It's trying to account for you swinging down and trying to hit it square on. And there might be cases where you don't want to hit it square on, where you do want to give it a little bit of that curve by hitting either to the left or the right of the club.
Mm-hmm. Then there's also, I don't know about in the golf game, but in Mean 18, as part of this three-click thing, there's also a power meter that is filling up in between one of those three clicks. So you determine the power of your swing by waiting until that power meter is to the place that you want it to be for the power of the swing you want, and then doing a click to lock in your power. You know, Famicom Golf came out, VS Golf came out before Mean 18 did. So they have some similar systems. I don't think Bradford took inspiration from it, because I think he was developing his own system at the exact same time. It was kind of parallel evolution. When it came to American computer golf games, they were really following more in the footsteps of Mean 18 than NES or Famicom or VS Golf. As you say, the principles are very similar. This unlocked computer golf in a whole new way that suddenly made it fun and interesting that it had never been before. Mike Smith is a developer, not a publisher, so Bradford finishes this game, needs someone to publish it. He knows people at Accolade, of course, because they were all at Activision briefly, and so Accolade's one of the people he approaches. Accolade just loves the thing. They agree to publish it. Again, the rest is history. You know, it sells over 100,000 units. The other thing that was very key about Mean 18 is because Bradford was so into golf generally, he also built a course designer into the game so players could design their own courses. The reason that ended up being a very important feature that was included in there is after Mean 18 was a success, Activision's management was trying to think of ways that they could exploit this game even more, because by this time they're already starting to think in terms of franchises. You know, they already have a winning franchise at this point with Hardball, and they're definitely keen to have more franchises, especially in the sports area, which lends itself to releasing a sequel every few years. Annual sequels weren't quite a thing even in sports yet for another couple of years, but even at this date, it's understood that every couple of years or so, it's good to release a sports sequel. They were like, what can we do to make this even more impactful? Of course, often the answer to that kind of thing is a license. So they decided that they would get a license to go with the next version of Mean 18. Of course, the golfer at the time in these pre-Tiger Woods days, was, of course, the great Jack Nicklaus. One thing about Nicklaus, in addition to, of course, just being an incredible golfer, which he was, he liked designing courses and, you know, he engaged in his own course design work. That kind of gave them a little bit of a leg up when going to Nicklaus to try to get a license. And they didn't deal directly with Nicklaus. They dealt with his people because, you know, he had a brand, so he had licensing people. They dealt with them, but they were able to secure that license. And so the follow-up to Mean 18 was released as Jack Nicklaus's greatest 18 holes of major championship golf. That license ended up, just like Hardball, being another one of these evergreen licenses that for years and years and years afterwards was a major moneymaker and a major earner for Accolade. As successful as both Hardball and Jack Nicklaus Golf were, by far the most important and most profitable franchise that the company came up with was a little thing called Test Drive. Just like these other products that we just talked about, Test Drive was not an internal development, but was developed by an outside company, in this case, Distinctive Software. The story of Distinctive Software and Accolade goes entirely back to this whole porting thing. As I said earlier, Accolade was very keen to port their games to as many other systems as possible. They were entirely dependent on outside developers to do that because they did not want to waste the time of their internal development staff working on these stupid little ports. They went to Artek. Now, by this time, Artek was making original fare for them. They made Ace of Aces, like we said. They also created another flight simulator game that was successful after that called Dam Busters. They went to Artek and said, we're looking for somebody to port Hardball 2 to the Apple II computer. Do you have any recommendations? The people at Artek/Sydney said, well, there's only one person you should be going to for that, and that is Don Matrick at Distinctive Software. The reason they knew each other is Distinctive Software was also a Canadian company. And in fact, Sydney Development Corporation, which Artek was a part of, had published Distinctive Software's first game back in 1982, Evolution. So they knew each other really well. Don Matrick was a genius coder who went on to have a very long career in the video game industry as an executive at places like Electronic Arts, Microsoft's Xbox division, and Zynga. But before all of that executive stuff, he was a real hotshot programmer. He and a friend, Jeff Sember, founded Distinctive in 1982 when he was just 17 years old, founded this company and released their first game professionally, which did very well. Evolution, as I said, released through Sydney Development Corporation. You know, and they kind of built a small, steady business after that, and they were just really good at what they did. Tom Frazina got in touch with Matrick and said, you know, can you port this? And Matrick said, not only can I port this, but I will port it so it looks just as good as your Commodore 64 version. I will get it done in 4 months, and it's just going to cost you $8,750. This is all according to Tom Frazina, whom I have interviewed. Frazina said, great, go do that. And Matrick delivered exactly what he promised. He got it done fast. It looked really good in relation to the C64 version, and he didn't ask for any additional money for overruns or anything. They were fast, they were good, and they were cheap. So that was the beginning of a very fruitful relationship for both companies. After that, just as Accolade tended to do, they invited Distinctive to start creating original games that Accolade would publish. The first one they made was a quirky little thing called Comics that was then branded Accolade Comics, since it was published by Accolade. It wasn't particularly successful, and it was meant to be the beginning of a series. The series never materialized, I think, because the first one didn't do very well, but it was an interesting idea. They basically created an engine where you would have these stories told via cutscenes that were like comic book panels. And then in between this kind of semi-animated comic book panel story that's being told, you would have mini games that you had to perform to advance the story. So they released one that had a kind of 007 secret agent theme, which was supposed to be the first of many, I think. But as I said, it kind of stopped there because it wasn't successful. But an interesting idea, even though it didn't quite pan out.
Looking at a C64 version of Accolade Comics, it reads like a comic with some light animation in it. And then go to the next page, there's some more animation and whatever the story is. And you got a choice to make on a few of them. Presumably that changes how the story goes.
Exactly. And then you have some mini games that are thrown in there as well, some action games that periodically appear that you have to get through as well. Kind of an interesting idea, you know, just like Law of the West, an interesting idea of a way to try to integrate a different entertainment medium within the video game medium. But just like Law of the West, it never really quite caught the public's imagination. With Accolade Comics not doing that great, Don Matrick was of the opinion that the next product that Distinctive did for Accolade had to be really cutting edge, really top notch, because Distinctive at this time, obviously in just a couple of years, because of Test Drive, they're going to become one of the most desirable developers in the entire industry. But at this time, they're still proving themselves. And so they kind of need to do a little better than comics. Don Matrick was and is a phenomenally big gearhead. He loves cars. He loves driving fast cars. He loves working on fast cars. He loves reading about fast cars. He loves everything that has to do with fast cars. His idea for the follow-up game is, let's create a game that just simulates some of the greatest fast luxury cars in the world and then turn you loose to race those things on courses consisting of lots of curvy mountains and twists and turns and all of this kind of stuff. Of course, the game that comes out of that is the 1987 release Test Drive. It combines some things. I'm sure he had to have drawn some inspiration from the arcade as well, because it combines some things that you already were seeing in the arcade in OutRun from Sega and Chase HQ from Taito. This idea that these luxury cars, it's different from a racing game. It's different from a game like Pole Position. The point of this is not to be in a race with other drivers and be on some kind of closed course. The point of this, just like with OutRun, is trying to just recreate the thrill of going out on a real road and just pushing the pedal to the floor and taking advantage of all of the power of this incredible machine that you're driving. The gameplay is all about driving along roads and avoiding traffic and having to evade the police from time to time, too, which, of course, also features in Chase HQ. Just having this feel of these powerful cars, which in the original game was the Lamborghini Countach, the Lotus Esprit Turbo, which according to Frazina, who's also a gearhead and so loved the idea of doing this game, was really only in there because Matrick had one. Frazina was pretty disdainful of the Lotus Esprit Turbo, but Matrick had one and really wanted it in the game. A Corvette C4, a Porsche 911, and a Ferrari Testarossa. Lotus aside, some of the most desirable luxury sports cars in existence. Boy, this game was a phenomenal hit. In the U.S., you know, Hardball was the bestseller. It hit somewhere between 100,000 and 250,000. It didn't reach that next tier, we know from the charts. But you see, another thing that set Accolade apart in this early period is that they very quickly got their product into Europe. They made a deal with U.S. Gold, a British publisher that was established by Jeff Brown specifically to source some of the best American software and port it and repackage it and repurpose it for the European markets, hence the name U.S. Gold. Accolade was one of their very early customers. So all of these games that I've been talking about, that's why there's a hardball port on the ZX Spectrum. All of these games that we've been talking about have also been hitting Europe with a very strong European publisher behind them. U.S. Gold's one of the strongest publishers in the U.K. So Test Drive is a massive success, not just in North America, but also in Europe. And so sells hundreds of thousands of copies. It very likely topped the 500,000 mark eventually, though we don't have full sales figures for it. But I wouldn't be surprised if it passed 500,000. I mean, this was just a massive hit. And of course, again, it started a franchise that became the premier franchise all the way up until the end of the company. This was the one. And then, of course, Don Matrick. Distinctive is bought by EA. Don Matrick's now at EA. And wouldn't you know, a little bit later, they start coming out with releases in a little series called Need for Speed, which is basically EA doing its take on the Test Drive series. Though, in all fairness, the original creator of Test Drive was now at Electronic Arts, so it's not so much a ripoff as it is, okay, now I'm at this company, I can't make Test Drive games anymore, so we'll make something similar and call them Need for Speed. Test Drive is one of the primary influences on the Need for Speed franchise as well, so this truly is the big one from Accolade.
Test Drive did not play the original one, but I did play the SNES port of the second one a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Really enjoyed that. A lot of fond memories of us just sort of cracking up as we're like running away from the cops or we get caught by the cops. And if you look really closely, you can see the name that's written at the end of the cop ticket thing. It's usually some derogatory name of some sort. It's just really, really funny. I'm looking at videos of Test Drive on the C64 and on DOS. What you have to realize here, this is sort of like the flight sims, where they're getting high-speed action at fairly decent speeds for the hardware.
Yeah.
The C64 port, you're looking at maybe 10 to 15 frames per second. That's enough to react to the cars that are on the road. And you have a parallax thing where you see a car in the distance. You have a few frames before it starts getting closer and closer very rapidly towards you. If you're not out of the way because it's a two-lane highway, you're going to have a head-on collision and then get set back.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have cops that will, of course, try to pull you over for speeding and so on and so forth. So it's really fascinating that they could even get this to look this good and have it update the view screen on the C64. The DOS version looks even better. You're looking closer to 20, even approaching 30 frames per second. That's almost smooth graphics at that point.
Exactly.
Which is really, really fantastic for a racing game back then. As we've said before, especially with all the other racing games that are very popular in Europe, that was the main driver for the PlayStation in Europe was racing games.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Europe has a history of loving racing games, fast cars, the open road, all that fun stuff. I can see how it can really appeal to those kinds of people.
Exactly. So yeah, this was the big one. And so, you know, the company hits 1990 doing pretty well for itself. It's still a modestly sized company. It hasn't grown aggressively. You know, it never took VC money. So there was never any pressure to go public because VCs always want you to go public at some point because the whole point is that's how they get their investment back, you know, 100-fold or whatever, if your company's successful. So, you know, they're a company that's probably worth about 8 to 10 million. They're closely held and they stay closely held through this entire period. But they've got a nice, steady business going with several franchises, Test Drive, Hardball, and Jack Nicklaus Golf, that are somewhat evergreen, at least at this point. I want to end our look at part one, which is a couple more tidbits and a couple more games. Despite the fact that the company is doing very well, there is some dissension within. I don't know all the details of this because neither side wants to talk about it. Neither side wants to dig up mud from the past. But as the company grows, it becomes more and more apparent that there is a complete disconnect between primarily Alan Miller, though Bob Whitehead also agreeing with him, but you know, Miller's still the more business-focused on the one side and Tom Frazina on the other side. I don't know exactly what the disagreements are about. Like I said, nobody wants to talk, but they all acknowledge that there was a fundamental difference of opinion on how to run the company. This ends with Tom Frazina being asked to leave in 1987. He goes on and founds his own company, 360 Pacific, and then after that, he has a long career with Electronic Arts. So, I mean, he lands on his feet just fine. But Tom Frazina is ousted in 1987 as president of the company. And then after a brief interregnum, while they looked for a replacement, they end up bringing in one of their old colleagues from Activision by the name of Alan Epstein. Alan Epstein was the original VP of operations at Activision. He was the guy that was responsible for setting up their entire cartridge production operation, manufacturing operation, all of that kind of stuff. After he did that for a couple of years, he wanted a new challenge, and so he became the VP of business development at Activision. And then after doing that for a little bit, he was ready to move on to the next level. He really wanted to lead his own company, so he left Activision and ended up joining a group called Presentation Tools that was formed around an idea some Polaroid people had, where they were like, you know, those slides that people do presentations with? Slides are really annoying. Wouldn't it be cool if you could just, like, make a slide on a computer, and then you could, like, edit that slide right on the computer, and then you could present the slide from the computer? That's never going to take off, right, Jeffrey? That's just crazy talk.
It is very much crazy talk, and I don't have to see those almost every week.
That's right. So, you know, we're talking about one of the very early slide programs in the vein of PowerPoint. So he left Activision to head this thing up. Then this thing got just lost and buried in kind of collateral damage in a series of lawsuits between Polaroid and Kodak over instant camera technology, which is not what he was working on, but it became a casualty of this larger lawsuit. And so he was looking for something else to do. And of course, the Accolade people had great respect for him from their days working together at Activision. So they asked him to come in and take over the company. In 1988, Alan Epstein becomes the CEO of the company, whom I have also interviewed. It doesn't really mean much of a change for the company's ways of doing business short term. I mean, they very much continue in the vein of what they were already doing in terms of, you know, exploiting these franchises, balancing in-house and external development, all of that stuff, and continuing to adapt with the times as well. One of the main trends that starts up, which we've talked about in other episodes in the late 80s, is there's this move towards what we would today call casual games. We did an episode on this, on early casual games, but games like Shanghai and Microsoft Solitaire and whatnot were starting to gain a lot of adherence in the late 80s, early 90s, because you had more and more professionals. With the costs of PCs coming down so much, you had more and more professionals that were buying a computer so that they could do work at home. They weren't necessarily buying it to be a gaming machine, but once that computer was in the home, they'd be looking at the software that was out there, and they would sometimes pick up a game or two, and they might not be action guys or RPG guys or adventure game guys, but some of these puzzle type games can be very interesting. Shanghai, I mean, there were certainly puzzle games before Shanghai, but in the United States, Shanghai was kind of the first game that kind of really inaugurated this fad. I bring that up especially because that game came out via Activision and was discovered, not created, but discovered by a producer at Activision by the name of Brad Freger. We talk about all of this in one of our casual games episodes, but basically, not long after getting Shanghai released by Activision to massive, massive success, Freger decides to leave Activision and found his own company that's dedicated to creating its own games with a real focus on kind of these more casual types of games. Once he's at his own company, he ends up getting approached by another guy he used to work with at Activision by the name of Michael Feinberg, who Freger had actually hired as an associate producer at Activision, and then got laid off because Activision during this time period is going through horrible, horrible things, which we talk about in other episodes. Then ends up going to work with this group that's working with Timothy Leary of LSD fame, who for a brief period of time was really fascinated with computers and computer games. He had put together a little development group that was trying to create a casual kind of puzzle game. Feinberg joined this group and over a frantic 72-hour period just got hit with this huge inspiration and completely demoed out a complete puzzle game, you know, created a board game version of it. But the intent was to make it a computer game. The board game was just to demo it. Wrote down all the rules and created this board game demo and brought it to Freger and was like, hey, I've come up with this great game idea. It was basically reverse Shanghai. Shanghai uses Mahjong tiles, and the idea is you have the turtle formation on the screen, and you have to match tiles to remove all the tiles from the board. the game that Feinberg came up with, which at this point doesn't have a name, which is why I keep referring to it as Feinberg's game rather than by its release name, is about placing initially beads, but later on more like tiles or stones, more similar to something in Mahjong, onto a board in various patterns to be successful. He took it to Fregger and was like, you know, I came up with this thing. And Fregger's like, oh yeah, this is great. I love it. Then the people at Leary's company were completely uninterested in it. They were like, just throw that thing out. Nobody will ever want that. So he kind of dejectedly told that to Fregger. This all comes from Fregger's autobiography he's actually written. Fregger was like, no, it's awesome. We're going to do this thing. Fregger's company is a developer, not a publisher. So, you know, they bring Feinberg in to develop this game, which they end up giving the name Ishido, which is literally gibberish. It's a word that was chosen to sound Japanese, but it is not a Japanese word. It has no meaning in Japanese. They create this game, Ishido, Way of Stones. And then they go on this huge roundabout attempt to try to get it published. At this point, Fregger's company is working very closely with Spectrum Holobyte. It looks like Spectrum Holobyte's going to take the game. Then Spectrum's British management, because through corporate shenanigans, they're part of the Maxwell Group. We tell some of that in our Tetris episode. The British decide they completely sour on everything that Fregger's doing and so end up nixing not just that deal, but also other deals that Spectrum Holobyte had with Fregger. When Spectrum Holobyte falls through, they start shopping it around and then they bring it to Epix, which we've done an episode on. Epix is super excited about it. They think it's great and they license it. Then Epix starts hurtling towards bankruptcy, as we talk about in our Epix article. So now there's a real problem. Because Epix has the publishing rights, and Epix may not be able to publish it, where if they are able to technically just sneak it out the door, they won't be able to market it effectively. The contract with Fregger's company does state that the rights revert to Fregger if Epix is not able to effectively sell the game. Of course, there's a lot of wiggle room and a lot of interpretation that goes into what exactly it means that they can't effectively market it. Epix is maintaining, oh, we're going to put this out. We have the money to publish this. Fregger is basically coming back and saying, well, even if you do sneak it out, there's no way with your financial situation you can actually effectively do anything with it. The game's kind of stuck in this limbo at this point. It's finally resolved when Fregger gets in touch with Accolade, because he's trying to shop around again in the hopes that he can get this thing back from Epix and land it with another publisher. He connects with Accolade, and the Accolade folks are so impressed by it. Everyone keeps being impressed by it, and then it's just a cursed game. The Accolade folks are so impressed by it, they not only agree to publish it, but they agree to cover, in the form of a loan, any legal costs that will be necessary to go to court and get the rights back from Epix. They're not just paying them outright, they're doing it in the form of a loan. But Fregger's very confident in the success of this game, and so he's very confident that their royalties that they get on the game are going to be able to pay back those legal costs and still make them a healthy profit. So for him, he considers that a great deal. So they go to court, and the judge basically, according to Fregger in his autobiography, the judge is basically like, why are you bothering me with this? The contract says that if they can't effectively market it, then they lose the rights to it. It's very clear they can't effectively market it, so just go and follow your damn contract. They had to pay, you know, a few tens of thousands in legal costs just for that, but at least Accolade covered the cost for him. And then once free of that, finally, Accolade releases this game, and it is, once again, a very nice hit. They kind of tap into this emerging casual field, and they have themselves another hit product in 1990. The second big game of 1990 is a little game that starts another very popular franchise called Star Control. Again, we're not going to go hugely into Star Control in this episode because the creators of it, Toys for Bob, very much are worthy of their own episode, and so we don't want to step on that here. But just to give the real basics of it, Star Control is a game that was basically, Paul Ritchie had worked on the game Archon for Electronic Arts. The idea behind Star Control was basically to take the strategic board game gameplay of Archon, which had a fantasy theme, transfer that to outer space, and then have the combat elements, have it work kind of similar where you're on this board and you're moving around strategically, and then when you collide with an enemy fleet, it goes to a combat. Have the combat be based entirely on the game Space War. Yes, that Space War. They were familiar with the original Space War, and they basically created a game where the combat engine was Space War. But they layered on top of that the strategic map mode and all of these very wild and creative alien designs and came up with this Archon in space game, Star Control, which once again, you know, they took it to Accolade. Accolade was very interested. Accolade published it, and it was another nice hit. You know, despite some of the management turmoil and the CEO turnover here, Accolade is kind of moving from strength to strength as the 1980s give way to the 1990s. Their internal development is maybe not as robust as it had been, but they've created a lot of relationships with a lot of great outside developers. They have wonderful distribution in the US. They have a great deal with a publisher in the United Kingdom to get their product over into Europe. They have multiple franchises they can exploit, and they seem to be poised for a period of even greater success. At the beginning of the 1990s, of course, pursuing greater success means turning attention to the console market. As we will see in part two of our Accolade retrospective, the move into the console market, specifically into the Sega Genesis market, will be the first in a series of very, very, very messy dominoes that will fall and will ultimately bring about the downfall of the company within a decade.
You wouldn't think going into the console industry during the 16-bit era would cause that, but here we are.
Well, for those of you that have listened to our video game lawsuits episodes, you'll know that that can be a bit of a dicier thing to do when you decide not to follow the licensing protocols. But that's all for part two. That is not a today topic.
Licensing protocols.
Yes.
Well, I hope you all get your protocols in order, because we'll have to see you next time on They Create Worlds. Check out our show notes at podcast.theycreateworlds.com, where we have linked to some of the things that we discussed in this and other episodes. You can check out Alex's video game history blog at videogamehistorian.wordpress.com. Alex's book, They Create Worlds, The Story of the People and Companies that Shaped the Video Game Industry, Volume 1, can now be ordered at CRC Press and at major online retailers. Email us at feedback@theycreateworlds.com. Please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/theycreateworlds. Please help get the word out by leaving a review on your favorite podcasting service. Intro music is Airplane Mode by Josh Woodward. Found at joshwoodward.com/song/airplane mode, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Outro music is Bacterial Love by Rollo Music. Found at freemusicarchive.org, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License.